My name is Juliet Grames, and I'm the author of The Lost Boy of Santa Chionia.
Juliet Grames' new novel, The Lost Boy of Santa Chionia, follows 27-year-old Francesca, an American of Italian-Danish heritage, who moves to the remote town of Santa Chionia in southern Calabria to open a nonprofit-funded nursery school. But trouble arrives when she does, as a catastrophic flood reveals long-buried human remains, and none of the locals claim to know anything about it. It's a mystery packed with intricate family secrets, interconnected family trees, danger, and vivid country Italian culture. From KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network, this is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay, and here's my conversation with Juliet Grames. Could you give our listeners a description of this book?
Absolutely. So The Lost Boy of Santa Chionia is the story of a 27-year-old woman named Francesca Lawfield in 1960. And Francesca is an American woman from Philadelphia. She is a PhD dropout who has ended up in southern Italy working for a charity organization. And she's in this tiny village called Santa Chionia, deep in the Aspromonte Mountains, which is in southern Calabria, very beautiful, very remote place, when there's a catastrophic flood and it uncovers a skeleton, an unidentified skeleton in the middle of the village. And this is just a catalyst for an adventure that will end up reshaping her life, because the police don't come and investigate the skeleton. It's very remote. This is a region that historically there are rumors that there's endemic mafia everywhere, but just, you know, she's just there to try to help people to build nursery schools for children. And, you know, she shouldn't really be investigating who these remains belong to, but she just can't help herself. She's a victim of her own compassion. So when she's approached by an older woman who says, "I think this may be my missing son who immigrated to America 40 years ago and was never heard from again," she starts digging. That is what the book is about.
I want to talk about this region because I tried to look up on Google Earth, Santa Chionia. Is this a real place?
So Santa Chionia is not a real village. unfortunately, because I really want to go there now, having spent the last 7 years writing about it. So what happened is my family is actually from Calabria. My grandmother was born there in 1920, and I am deeply fascinated by Southern Italy and its history and its culture and how many of us Americans, United States of Americans, have our immigrant antecedents in Southern Italy. It's a place we don't know about or read about or visit as tourists. So I've always wanted to uncover secret history there. And one thing you'll find when you dip your toe into those waters is there are ghost towns all over Calabria. There are towns that were forcibly depopulated or depopulated by immigration during the 20th century. And I find them completely haunting. And I became obsessed, absolutely obsessed with a real ghost town called Africo, which was forcibly depopulated in 1950. I was fascinated by its history, by why the people were forced to leave or chose to leave, by the advent of mafia in that town after people were pushed out. And I knew I wanted to write about it. I wanted to write about that decision to leave a place that is, you know, a cultural heritage heart spot. So, but I didn't want to write about actual Africo. Many people have written about Africo. So I invented Santa Chionia. It's a neighbor of Africo. It's deep in the mountains. There's no roads that go to this village at all. There's no doctor who lives there who can treat people. There's no electricity or running water. But what there is a very strong ancient culture that has been there for 1500 years. There is a way of eating that is different from anyone else's cuisine. There is a language that is retained there, a language called Greco. It's actually a form of Byzantine Greek with classical elements to it and Calabrian dialect. And these are all real qualities of the villages in that area. I just wanted to spin them into a place where I could create a crime narrative, a murder mystery, without actually implicating any real people.
So you call this a murder mystery, and I hesitate to classify it under that one genre because it's also very literary and worldly. But to focus on the mystery aspect for a minute, how did you plot out the story? Did you let the writing guide you, or did you have a solid idea of how it would unfold when you began?
So there are two ways of coming at any story for me. One of them is structural. I'm definitely one of those writers who bullet points absolutely everything. I bullet point an email before I send it. So you better believe I certainly plotted this. The plot is complex. I wanted it to be a true puzzle for mystery readers who love that kind of thing. I wanted it to surprise and challenge them. So I plotted the heck out of it. And that was complicated and really super fun. Building that puzzle was super fun. But I think also within any scaffolding of a story like that, if you are a plot forward writer like I am, you need to make sure that there is a beating heart to it too. And I had the beating heart. I knew what I wanted. Francesca, my main character, her struggle is the same as mine. She is going through her day-to-day life trying to figure out how to be a good person. And in her case, she's taken this drastic action of committing her entire life to charity work. She has left her home behind. She's left her family. I mean, I don't want to spoil anything. She's left a lot behind to go do this work. And it has cost her a lot. And the question is, within this framework of being a good person, is she doing the right things? Is she actually helping people around her? Or is she, you know, butting into stuff that she shouldn't be involved in? These are questions I ask myself every day. So I had a lot of that personal energy to put into that scaffolding of the plot.
You know, Francesca was helping women who thought that the bones that were discovered were either like their husband or their son, men who had immigrated and they had not heard from them again. Can you talk to me about that?
I can. That was the origin. That was the fire that started this story, was during my interviews among the Italian American and diaspora communities. I found that I spoke to family after family after family who had someone in their deep background, an uncle or a cousin or a grandfather's brother, who had sailed away to America, usually America, but maybe Australia or Germany, or to seek opportunity, and then who was just never heard from again. You can see every time I say this, I get goosebumps. It's such a creepy story to think that there's a limb of your family tree that has been severed and you don't know what happens. And I will tell you, I have this in my family. My husband has this in his Italian American family. And when I saw that confirmation that it occurs again and again, here's the thing you don't know. Was he a victim of all of the dangers that are included in the immigration process? Did he die trying to get to the place where he was going to seek his fortune? Was he killed by exploitative labor practice? You know, so much of the immigrant life is not protected, is vulnerable. Was he perhaps a victim of organized crime? And this is true, that there are always organized criminal syndicates that prey on immigrants in every community. Even now, this is a question in immigration, is how immigrants are vulnerable to crime. Or, hey, was he just a scoundrel? Did he just sail off and be like, I don't want to pay for my wife and children anymore? I mean, did he go marry some other woman and have children somewhere else? You don't know. You don't know. Was this missing Uncle Dominic, if he was a victim or a scoundrel? And it leaves this hole in our hearts. I knew that right there, that was the meat of a murder mystery plot, or a mystery plot, I should say. And that's how I created this character of Francesca Lawfield, the de facto immigrant detective. She's basically doing the work that I have been doing, sort of method acting my way through this research process into the Italian diaspora. If you dig into these stories, you will find missing men, and you will start to wonder where they went, and can we find them after 120 years? Can we find them? And the answer is sometimes yes.
I want to talk about Francesca for a minute, because she's caught between two cultures. You know, she's in that isolated Italian village. And then she also has her home in Pennsylvania, and she brings a taste of American culture to Santa Chionia, you know, with a stuffed animal knockoff of Zippy the Chimp from the Ed Sullivan Show, and she, you know, her love of I Love Lucy. She's really caught between two completely different worlds, isn't she?
She is. She is. And this is a book about the Italian diaspora. It really is. I consider myself a lifelong student of that. I am myself, you know, my mother was born in the United States, like Francesca, but of people of Italian stock. And I think, you know, the Italian experience, thinking about what elements of your culture you're going to honor and take with you, and which elements you know, we left behind for a reason. Those are questions a lot of us ask ourselves, preservation, you know, of our heritage versus moving on and having a better modern life. And I think there's an analogous conversation for many of us children of immigrants for what our people left behind or didn't. In the case of Italian culture in particular, and the reason I wanted to write about 1960, it's very hot button moment, especially in the female agency conversation. This moment of what is a woman? What is a woman's body? Who does it belong to? What are women's rights? Are women citizens? All of these conversations are happening in real time in Italy and are so analogous to so many of the conversations we're having today. So, you know, Italy at this time was a place where women really didn't have equal rights, even though they had become citizens of the Italian state in 1945 after the war. They still didn't have access to things like divorce, which means that if you were in an abusive marriage, there really wasn't anything you could do to protect yourself. And that's just one example. And so those patriarchal forms that really dot some of the cultural heritage that we have received as Italian Americans and things we have chosen to leave behind were really interesting to me. Francesca is a very liberated woman. She has, her parents wanted her to have the world. They gave her an excellent education. They gave her the tools to do better than they did. And for a while, she pursued that in a very straightforward way when you hear about her past, but she's always sort of also struggled with that identity as an Italian and wanting to be closer to it, which brings her back to Italy. And in that way as well, she's a lot like me.
You know, you talk about the women's roles in Santa Chionia, and one of the practices that kind of blew my mind was when a marriage wasn't approved and how that could be forced. Can you talk about that a little bit? Can you, and is that a real thing?
Absolutely. So the word that I use in the book is fuitina, and that is a regional word. It's used in Sicily and Calabria. However, it's a concept that existed a lot in Italian Catholic villages for a very long time. So fuitina means to escape. That's the literal translation. It means elopement. And so it's when a marriage is not, you know, a courtship that then develops into a Catholic sort of ceremony in a church in the traditional way. So fuitina takes two forms, or historically took two forms. One of them was, okay, say that there's a young couple who are in love, but they're not approved by their parents, but they really want to get married. And so they might do an elopement where a sympathetic aunt or uncle or something is like, oh, come over to my house and spend the night together. And here's the thing, in these very strict Catholic structures, once virginity is in the question, marriage must happen, right? Otherwise, you can't be redeemed before God. A redemptive, reparative marriage. That's what fuitina is. It repairs an act against God that, you know, by bringing a marriage about after loss of virginity. So in that way, elopement can be quite romantic. And then the parents have to approve and the couple gets married. Or you might even use it to just describe regular elopement. We don't want to spend a lot of money on a wedding. However, throughout Italian history, and this isn't much discussed, but it's very present. And I think an Italian American family will be aware of this structure because they may very well have it in their past. The other kind of fuitina is when a man wants to marry a woman and she does not want to marry him. Maybe she's in love with someone else. Maybe she just doesn't want to marry him and she feels it's her right to decline. And so there have been crimes throughout Italian history where a man forces a woman to marry him, to engage in a reparative marriage by raping her. He may do it alone. He may do it with buddies who help him make this marriage happen. The thought is that once her virginity has been lost, the only way she can repair herself before God is to submit to the marriage. And as much as I hate to even think about or talk about this topic, it was really a very present. It occurs a lot in the research that I did, in the reading I did, in conversations I had with people. And there have been some really brave women, especially in the 1960s, there was a Sicilian woman named Franca Viola who literally fought the Italian government. Her would-be suitor, the word I would use is rapist, but the man who raped her, who wanted to marry her, he sued her for marriage because he didn't you know, want to go to court, or he didn't want to have to go to jail for his crime. And what I should tell you is, in the Italian legal code, up until 1996, rape is actually not a criminal offense. It's a social offense. So that's why a man is able to repair a woman by marrying her after he rapes her. So Franca Viola goes on to literally fight the court. And the case goes up to higher and higher courts for her right to not marry her own rapist. She was so brave, and she faced off against the state, against her neighbors who just wanted the problem to go away, against her priest who wanted the problem to go away. That's a very famous case. But at the time, Francesca, so this is about 10 years before that is when this story is set. And during my research, I encountered these stories of bravery of women who were starting to try to cast off that system, even on this village to village basis. It's very present, very relevant.
I want to talk about all of the characters and how you kept them straight, because there are so many names and there are people who are related to each other. I mean, what does I assume it's like a family tree when you look at the characters in this village. What does it look like, and how did you keep track?
So this is such a fascinating part of life in these very remote villages, especially in the Aspromo de Mountains, where people retrenched when they were trying to fight off feudalism, when they were trying to avoid paying taxes they didn't want to pay to the Italian government. There's a spirit of resistance in these villages, and also of secretiveness. So there's a lot of endogamy. There's a lot of marriage inside the town. You really don't marry out. And first cousin marriage is, in fact, encouraged, because then you know the mom, you know the dad. In-laws have known their new daughter-in-law since she was born. It's really helpful in maintaining secrecy and maintaining family wealth when there's almost no family wealth to be had in these villages. At the same time, when everyone is related like that, if something goes wrong, it becomes very, very hard to walk away. So if there is an element of criminality that occurs in this village, sort of everyone is implicated and everyone suffers. I don't believe it's a coincidence that in a very marginalized village like Santa Chionia, where the culture is one of resistance and avoiding government brutality, you also get a lot of endemic organized crime. It's just what happens. Keeping the characters straight was tricky for me, because there are a lot of characters and they're not all honest about how they're related to one another. So I learned a lot about them as I was writing about them. Too. It was definitely a challenge, and they kept surprising me. So for readers, we have put a character guide in the book that will hopefully help a little bit keeping everybody straight.
I was also fascinated by the Christmas celebration. Was that based on something that happens? I mean, Santa Chionia is not real, but is this Christmas celebration real?
Yes. Oh, yes. I had the great fortune of doing a really revelatory research trip in the Aspromonte in the December of 2019. I was there for a long time, and I got to visit a bunch of different villages and interview people about their lives in general. But because the Christmas traditions were all present around me, it is so special. It is really, really special. And traditions vary from village to village. So what I did was I cherry-picked a lot of them and wove them into Santa Chionia's traditions, but they're just magical. You have to imagine this remote mountaintop village, completely disconnected from the rest of the world. Now it's very cold. We're probably trapped there because of weather. So what are we going to do? We are going to party 24/7. And one of the neatest things was there's a sort of incantatory mass that happens. They call it the novena, the 9 days before Christmas Eve, leading up to Christmas Eve. Everyone gets up for this mass at 3 o'clock in the morning, and it's a ruckus. Every morning you sing and dance for an hour, and sometimes there's bagpipes. I mean, sometimes it's can you even call this a religious service? Even though it happens in the church. And then people wander from house to house singing Christmas songs and exchanging roasted chestnuts and little tiny alcoholic drinks. I mean, this goes on for this haze of partying. It goes on for days and days, but in a religious way, in a like a respectful vegetarian way, because you know, we're not eating meat in those days of the Advent. And it's really cool. I also loved the New Year's Eve traditions I got to write about. And then these little holidays like St. Martin's Day, which is in November, and it's you know, Saint Martin, he was a real saint. However, his saint day happens to fall on the day that the season's wine is ready. Oh. So now what happens is the celebration of Saint Martin's is everyone is going around tasting their first wine of the season and they're frying donuts. It's like donut and wine day. I mean, it was really, really fun packing in all of those real cultural traditions into this book.
So online, you have a book club guide that includes a recommended menu, recipes, as well as like a music playlist. And the book was rich with descriptions of the meals, sometimes just tastes that Francesca experiences, from spicy sausages to chocolate-covered nuts. My mouth was just watering throughout. Can you talk about the role of food in Italian culture?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you about the role of food in my culture, which is, as a reader, I want to read about food. It's one of the main reasons that I love reading books set in other places. But yeah, it's central. I mean, food, it's not just that we eat it to nourish our bodies. There's also, very central in Italian culture, the act of sharing food and sitting down and having that food together. That is sacred. And what happens in the sharing of food is the sharing of stories. So for me, storytelling and food are completely intertwined. I think a lot of Italian Americans will tell you that. As an Italian American who has spent now 10 years researching the diaspora and trying to recreate his like these historical moments in Italian history, I will tell you it's also absolutely vital to research. Because by collecting a recipe, especially from an older member of a culture who may remember how these things were done back before there was electricity, before there was refrigeration, you don't just get the taste. You get the ingredients. You get the story of how these ingredients are sourced. You get the legacy of why that recipe is being consumed at a particular time of year. It may connect to the harvest, to what is available. Oh, we've just had a ton of rain. We're going to use all the mushrooms right now because they popped out. Or, oh, it's the middle of winter. The snows have closed the road. We don't have any access to grain. We're not going to eat pasta. We're going to eat lentils right now, those kinds of things. And so really to understand what people's lives were like, you get to understand how they spent their time in harvesting and cooking and preparation. It's so vital to making a realistic scene to set your story in. Plus, it presents a ton of conflict because actually sourcing food is a big occupation of your day in this lifestyle. And of course, what we're looking for in fiction is conflict, right? It's fantastic. I just have to tell you, I was really lucky. And among the many amazing new friends that I made during my research process who gave me their memories and just shared so much with me, I have to throw out a citation to a woman named Maria Volontà. At the moment of this recording, she is 99 years young. She is probably cooking something right now. I met her in 2019, and she and her daughter, Antonella, who is an architect, the two of them kept in touch with me all throughout the pandemic via WhatsApp while I was writing this book. And I'd be like, Maria, I need to make that chickpea casserole. I have it in this scene that, you know, Francesca and Chica need to bring it over to a neighbor's house. Can you remind me of how the layers go? And, you know, she'll send me a video of herself making the chickpea casserole. So this 99-year-old woman who remembers history, she was, you know, born in 1926. She never handled money until she was 30 years old because she lived this very secluded village country life. She's a native Greco speaker. She was such a gift to me. And she and other members of her community who helped me bring these cultural details to life. I'm grateful to have this book as a preservation of that culture, and anyone I can share it with, that's not just a gift to me, it's a gift to them as well, that people are remembering what they did for all those years.
Was she your inspiration for Chica? Because that is one character who you don't know what you're getting at first, and you know what happens to Francesca happens to the reader, where you just kind of end up loving her.
No, Maria Volontà was very directly my inspiration for a very important character named Emilia in the book. Oh, okay. I borrowed her description. Yeah. Chica, the character of Chica, I'm afraid came out of my imagination, and she's a very personal antagonist, protagonist to me. I love Chica. Chica is Francesca's landlady, and the two of them have, they butt heads. They do. So, yeah, I love Chica to death.
So you are editorial director at Soho Press. How has your experience as editorial director prepared you for writing your own fiction?
So as editorial director at Soho Press, what I do is I acquire and edit books, fiction, for us to publish. I've been in this job for 14 years, but I've been a book editor for 20 years. And I became a book editor because I wanted to be a writer. And coming out of college, I thought, oh, writing books, that's not a real career path. That's not something I'll ever actually be able to do. So I thought, oh, I'll help other people write their books instead. So I started editing. And I adore my job. I adore working closely with authors on taking their story and developing it into the absolute true platonic realization of what they wanted it to be at the beginning of their process. And I've had a lot of authors who have privileged me with that very intimate work on their material. I'm so grateful to them and everything that they've taught me. And I do have to say that all this time I kept writing, and you know, about 10 years into my editorial career, I thought, I want to pursue writing again. I can't leave that aside. It makes me sad to not be writing my own books. I have my own stories I'm desperate to tell. Like this one, it's just burning like a fire in me. I want to tell you about the Aspromonte so much. And so I went back to writing at that point. And I think the reason that I had any success in even getting to the end of the manuscript, never mind seeking publication at that point, was because I had learned how to edit. I believe 80% of writing is editing. And I knew I had the stamina to do it because I had worked with other people and I had learned a lot about all the different ways we can tell stories and what works and what doesn't work. And sometimes what we need to fight for, despite what everyone is telling us, you know, we should streamline out of our fiction. So I am very grateful to that experience. It did make me the writer I am.
Well, the book is The Lost Boy of Santa Kionia. Juliet Grahams, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you, Beth. This has been wonderful.
That was Juliet Grahams, author of the book The Lost Boy of Santa Kionia, which was published by Knopf. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR Podcast Network. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Luann Stevens and Haley Krausen. Our producers are Haley Krausen and Katie Lanning, and our marketing coordinator is Carly Cooper. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.